Hi, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Baroshi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a different page and invite the author of one of the articles onto the show to discuss their topic and more widely how they approach interactive writing. So it's all about the craft of interactive narrative. And this week we're really excited to have Kevin Van Oord with us. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you good. So much for joining us.
Of course.
First up, for the benefit of people who might not recognize your name, because us writers don't always get the top line credits for the projects that we work on, could you just introduce sort of who you are and how you fit into the industry and what projects you've worked on so people get a sense of where you're coming from?
Sure. I am a senior writer at Larian Studios. If you don't know who we are, we made Baldur's Gate 3, Divinity Original Sin 2, and a whole bunch of other games before that. And before that, if anybody's interested, I worked at Tryon Worlds for a little bit, working on a couple little projects, one of which saw, they're not around anymore. We'll just say that.
Okay.
And before that, a lot of people would probably know that I was reviews editor at GameSpot for 9 years. So that's okay. Sort of my background in the industry. It started as a critic and moved into development.
So far, we found that most of the people we interview on this podcast are either games journalists who took the step into games writing or opera singers for some reason.
the second biggest
category that we've uncovered.
Well, you know, I should probably throw out that I was a professional singer for a long time.
No!
Were you seriously? Were you actually?
No, I'm serious. My background is in music, so I studied to become an orchestral violinist and a composer. And on the side, since I could sing, I just did a lot of singing, and that was actually the easiest way for me to make money when I was younger. Was to get singing gigs rather than the other kind. So yeah, so
there we go.
I guess I'll keep
you are the Venn diagram, Kevin.
I've been waiting for this moment. Has landed.
Yeah.
Oh, fabulous!
Wonderful.
I definitely first encountered you in your critic guise. That's how I had recognized your name, and so I was delighted to see the contribution you made to the book. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that article. It's called Two Tips for Better Dialogues.
Yeah. Sure.
Go for it.
Sorry. Terrible title, by the way. I'll tell you how that article actually got started in my head and then what it became when I realized that it was well out of control what I was doing, because what I would have ended up with was some kind of 20,000 word treatise that would have made it your way. It started as really a discussion about so-called false choice in branching dialogue, and I realized I was really in over my head after I started writing, and so I sort of quickly just sort of truncated everything that I could into something that was more digestible, and just kind of kept it to two different things that sort of pointed to the same place, because I did want to talk about how people feel about whether choice is meaningful in an interactive dialogue, and what does meaningful actually mean in that context, and does that mean that you have to make a choice that has some grand or lasting effect in the world? Does it have to have some kind of effect within the dialogue itself? Or maybe it doesn't have to have any kind of mundane effect at all. Maybe it's just a choice that you make. And that's sort of how that began.
I do love that in an article about game choice, it appears that there's like a quantum universe version of this that was not just two tips, but like 1,000 tips. And so that's excellent just on its own. Let's dive into one of those two tips. Your second point is about efficiency and about specificity and just generally just being wary of bloated dialogue, which I thought was a particularly cool and interesting point to make in an article where you are often talking specifically about like the sort of self-expressive choices that you can make that might not lead into some other area. For many players, those extra little alleyways to take something into is something they love. They want to exhaust all of those points.
And yeah.
Maybe it's the case that that's just a subset of players, though. Like when you're designing, are you thinking of a certain type of player that wants to do every tree in their head, or are you thinking of kind of the golden path? How do you approach a conversation, let's say, when you're coming
to
that?
So this is interesting because, well, I will start by saying, we've talked about this, I think, in other places at Larry, and we sort of have a one-topic rule when it comes to an initial conversation with an NPC. So this doesn't mean that you can't go back and exhaust other things with them, but we do think of your initial interaction with an NPC as they have their topic. They're interested in the one thing that they're interested in. And that doesn't mean that later you can't exhaust many other things with them, but it does mean that we want people to be focused when they play on what's happening in the here and now. We want people to be invested in what the NPC is talking about, and we don't want the player to lose the plot. I don't want the player to lose the plot. If I walk up to somebody and I gave an example in my article that was sort of based on a game that I'd played recently. And I'm not going to name any names in the course of stuff like this, but I found myself like this was a very tense situation where, you know, somebody's going to have, you know, say an amputated limb in a hospital, and you're going through there. And this seems like would be a tense thing. It seems like this would be the subject of the moment when I walk in, and that however I interact with these people, that this would be important, that this would be the star of this dialogue. And instead it becomes very, very easy, very quickly to get lost in the weeds with asking about, tell me about this clinic, and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I find that kind of stuff feels stilted, unrealistic. It's not really how we talk. That doesn't mean that I think that game writers should write in ways that we talk in real life. That's a subject for another day. I don't necessarily ascribe to the idea that dialogue should sound like how people speak, at least how people like you and me speak. But I do think that in a dialogue like that, it's good to stay focused, because that's where tension and drama come from. And then you can open things up later when the drama and tension are done. So that's sort of how I go about an initial interaction with an NPC. It's like, this is the subject at hand, and we're going to increase the tension. We're going to make sure that we're being very specific here about what's going on in this conversation. Later on, now we have an opportunity to discuss more things that might be related to that situation.
So it sounds from that when you're saying that in conversations in games you've seen, other games, like it's easy for the conversation to kind of get lost in the weeds and to kind of disappear off on these tangents. I'm kind of interested in, I guess, how come that happens? Why do you think that happens? I mean, presumably, like, the reason that's relevant to you as a writer is it's something that you must tackle in your own writing, right? It's,
yeah.
Presumably it's something you have to fight against, or just at least notice when you've done it by accident. So where does that come from? Where does that urge to sort of bury the player in diversion?
I'll be honest, at least in my case, I don't want to speak for every writer out there, but I do think in my case that comes from fear. I think that it comes from fear of the player not knowing enough, not having enough context. Maybe we haven't, especially in an open world game or a game where you've made so many choices that I don't know how you arrived at this place, and I still have to write this scene and hope that you understand all of the context that's going on in this scene. So I think that a lot of that stuff comes from fear of the player simply not having all the context, or worry that if I don't give them the information here, that they may not get it anywhere else. And sometimes I think that's valid. And I think, and I put some of this in my article, that there are small ways where you can just world build, where you can communicate, where you don't need to shove that into the dialogue. Sometimes there are ways to just tweak a line, and then you get some information to the dialogue that way without having to disrupt the whole thing. And sometimes you just have to trust that the player's going to figure it out. Players don't have to know every single thing. And I think that sometimes my inclination is to over-explain, and sometimes I think that just as a cadre of writers out there, in the universe that sometimes we have a tendency to over-explain, especially in maybe a lore-heavy game where a lot of things have happened before the player even arrived.
Yeah, I think definitely we're always worried about the player's attention and focus. Like, how much has the player even been listening to these dialogues in this dialogue-heavy game? Like, we never really know. I don't know whether dialogue, trying to solve that problem in dialogue is such a hard thing to do, because you're right, sometimes we can tweak a line and kind of bury the context in it, but then has that actually solved the problem, or has it just been ignored again?
It's a good question. I think we're lucky at Larian because we're not in a situation where, you know, we're not brought in at the last minute to kind of make sense of a level design and a gameplay and a this and a that and the other, and try to give it some kind of narrative after all is said and done. The writing is part and parcel of every single thing from the very, very beginning of the game. And so we're not only writers at Larian, but we're also quest designers. We're also, sometimes level decorators, sometimes, you know, there's all sorts of things that are going on there in terms of what we request, what we need. Like, we have, you know, designers, but we also have our scripters and we also have our writers. And that's kind of like a triad of people who are all working on a particular situation. And together, we create the narrative. And the narrative isn't just about the dialogue and about the words that are said and even about the plot that's being told. It's about, you know, what does the level look like and how is it decorated and what does the character look like and what are they wearing and what is the location and the set decoration and all of these things, you know, what is the color palette, you know, all of these things are storytelling. And I feel particularly lucky that we're all in it together from the beginning. So a lot of these problems are just solved straight up. We know the story that we want to tell, and if something's not working because it can't, if there's some kind of existential problem where a dialogue can't solve the story that we're telling, then sometimes that means that we just tell it a different way, or we find a way to get that missing piece in through something else, whether it be a readable. Readables are some of my favorite things. You can't always count on players to click on that readable, but you know, people do love reading that stuff in our games, in BG3 and in DOS2 and things like that. And so my take on it is, if you make it interesting and you make it worth it for people to click on it to see what that letter says, give those things as much personality and as much verve and as much color as the actual lines said out loud, then you'll probably draw people to clicking on those things and then we as writers get to fill in the blanks.
This is okay. Yeah. So this is a really good point, right? You're talking about interacting with the rest of your team, this extraordinary team of game developers that we have, and trying to produce the right moment, the right vibe for that particular scene. We've interviewed a number of writers who are at times over their career, a bit more external. They're brought in as a consultant or something in the way that you were describing, Kevin, or sometimes not. Sometimes they're really involved, but the team itself is smaller. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how you go about evoking this. Like you named a couple examples. Perhaps you talked about the waiting room being too crowded in your article and how, like, well, maybe you can just show that, right? Show that to be more crowded. Yeah. But for some teams, perhaps they can say, I literally cannot make any other human NPCs because I have a bank of three of them and that's all we get, right? Or say a readable. It might be like, well, you can do that, but you fundamentally have to negotiate for time for sort of an interactable asset that has some sort of 3D beauty, you know, beauty object that you can grab, and that may or may not work. How does that usually work in your capacity? What's that interface point between you and, let's say, the art team or anyone else that would be involved?
I mean, it's when we first get, you know, kind of a core story. The core story is sort of a document, a living entity, right? We have basically, here is our core story, and this comes from, you know, the very top, you know, our creative director Sven Vinka always has an idea of the story that he wants to tell, and this is something that, you know, could be unusual amongst big, you know, studios that at least have as many people working for them as we do at this point, is that the creative director starts with the story that he wants to tell. And that is a big boon for me as a writer, because that means that now I have resources, because he knows that I'm going to need resources if I'm going to tell the story that he's put down on the page along with the lead writers. And so when it comes to me, I know more or less what needs to be done, but it's gone first to designers. It's then gone to a scripter who puts in the situation so that it works before I ever start putting any words into it. Cool. I'm part of that process. I'm in the meetings. I say, the things that need to be said. If I see any potential problems with telling the story, I say them then. And then, boom. Now it lands on my lap, and I have to give this NPC words. I have to look at all the readables that are around it. I have to see it in the game. And we're almost always, when we first start the writing process, we already see it in the game. We have context for it. We know, certain things about where the location is. We know where it exists in the core story and so on. Exactly. So I go in and I start writing, and I can then test immediately once I get the lines in. And very quickly you can see what's missing or what won't work. Sometimes what's on the page, that's what's on the page, right? But it's only once it's in the game, once I'm starting putting words in there, I might then come up with ideas I didn't have before. Suddenly I'm creating characters and personalities and color. And now I know who this person is. I know what they say and what they won't say, what kind of choices they would let me to make. And then it's very iterative, Fitlarian, which is, it comes in one form, and by the time it goes out for, review, for Sven to look at, for the lead writers to look at, it may go out in a very different shape than when it started. But that's sort of our process, and that particular process, for me as a writer, comes down to four people. I'm not often interfacing directly with an artist, unless you count cinematic artists. Yes.
Right.
So the people that I'm mostly interfacing with are designers, scripters, and cinematic artists. And cinematic artists are incredibly important for our games now, because now we can do something we didn't used to be able to do in DOS 2, which is that we can use cinematics and motion capture to tell story. That's also a very big boon for a game like ours, because I can put off things to cinematics or to voice acting and things like that to communicate information or attitude that I don't have to worry about putting exactly in the words, because that stuff can be communicated visually or orally. And that's all a great boon. I feel like I got lost at the end of that.
No, you
Sorry.
Didn't. You didn't. That's but and actually, not at all. And I'd love to do just a little follow-up for that, because what you just covered, right, is incredibly interesting for me as someone who works in a somewhat parallel space to some degree, but also to writers who don't usually have that type of back and forth with fellow colleagues. I guess I want to put to you a situation I often find myself in, and I'm curious if you do, and perhaps it's really just me, but I often find we work at the Chinese Room often in a really similar way. Like we might well know exactly kind of how to build something, and the dialogue might come in over time, and it allows us to iterate and all of these things. But I find I'm in a meeting with, say, like a level designer and an artist and maybe the creative director, and we all already know the shape of the story, like you described, like the sense that, okay, we know that in this moment we need to introduce the antagonist or something, and they cannot be killed or confronted in this thing except verbally, let's say, right? People will come and turn to me then and say, "All right, what do you want now?" Right? And whatever I say is like remembered as if it has been carved in stone. And I find it's often really hard then to do iteration, because people will remember from that one meeting, especially if like a producer is there taking notes, and suddenly I am like locked into whatever that first idea was that I had had. That's an exaggeration. This doesn't always happen, and of course you can change things, but when you're working with like a team of other disciplines, I just find that information moves so quickly, and it's so easy to sort of diverge that. Do you find that you need to like walk in to that first meeting about what that level, what that is going to be, what that conversation is going to be, relatively complete in your notion of what the story is? Or how does that work for you?
No. I mean, I've been at Larian now for 10 years. So I have a pretty good handle on, you know, the old but forever important adage, to murder your darlings. And we know that there will be, in any given situation, 24 darlings murdered, at very, very least. It's very rare nowadays that any of us get so stuck on an idea that we simply have to have it. And that includes Sven. Like, if he has a grand idea that he thinks is the best thing that's ever happened, he sees it in game and it's like, oh, that's shit. Then it's shit, and out it comes. And that means, even if I've spent 2 months writing a dialogue for it, trying to iterate and iterate and iterate, you know, if it's not working, it's not working. And typically speaking, if it's not working, we don't hammer it in until we get something that's at least okay. You know, we just say, it's not working. Get rid of it now so that we can make something that's better. And that's so studio-wide that I don't think very many of us really get attached to an idea for a really long time that we feel something has to stay, especially because that's just not how Sven works. And so that's all, I hate to use the term, but that's all very trickle down in this sense. Like, it works that way at the top, and so therefore it works that way for all of us, is nobody's really getting attached to an idea.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And I almost feel like less voluntarily, like less like, oh, this is your one darling that you want to maintain, but rather just in the course of building something, to have even that first layer, that second layer, ideas, I guess, sometimes take a momentum of their own.
They do.
But if you have a correcting function where you review and you're able to kind of clear stuff, then iteration can proceed normally, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what you're, yeah.
I mean, I've wept. I've certainly spent plenty of time shedding tears over things that I had to say goodbye to. And yes, I have sometimes stubbornly held on to an idea where it's like, oh, well, I can't use it here. I'm sure that I can find a place for this idea somewhere else because it's so good. You know, maybe the next game. I have a fellow writer who had such a cool idea for a scene in Divinity Original Sin 2 that I still think of it. And it still hasn't appeared in one of our games. And I'm still attached to it. And I really hope that we find a place for it. So I don't know that I'm answering the question, but that's kind of how I view kind of the ownership and the sort of the emotional attachment to the things that we're individually making, as well as making as a studio.
So going back to your article, one of the things I really liked in it was there are a couple of things I really liked in it, but one of the things I really liked in it was talking about using how to use the NPCs to kind of leverage the NPCs to give conversations a bit more point and purpose and momentum, and to really sort of drive the plot forward. I wondered if you could speak a little bit about how you go about setting that up. How do you set up a world in which the NPCs are all really keen to just be up in the player's face the whole time? They've all got business the whole time. Like, how do you keep that momentum in the air, especially across the length of time of these incredibly long games? Like, is that difficult? Does it fall out of the structure? Like, where does that come from?
It sort of falls out. I mean, at least in Baldur's Gate 3, I mean, we had a whole bunch of companions who all had their own, they all had their own motivations. They were all basically on their own missions, their own quests when you meet them, but you're all kind of shoved together by this, you know, this fateful circumstance in which you have to band together if you're going to survive. How very RPG of those folks. But there are degrees of this stuff. And I think in my article, because this comes down to a good bank of player choices comes from being teed up by what the NPC has said before. And that often comes down to either a direct question, or some kind of leading phrase or statement that almost begs for some kind of response. Obviously, you can't do that for every single conversation that you have, but even in the small things. So, for example, you might have a dialogue where you're overhearing a conversation and you want to intrude and talk about what they're talking about. It's a lot better, in my opinion, for somehow the player to be invited into that situation or to at least be acknowledged, rather than the player saying, hey, by the way, I have an opinion about what you're talking about. Because now I feel like I've had to go out of my way to care. And honestly, as a player, if I see that in an RPG, I'm like, leave. You know, if this is something that the NPCs can keep between the two of them, then they can keep that between the two of them. But if the NPCs, but if they're saying, hey, you stranger, I mean, this is a really poor example of how to do it. But, you know, hey, you stranger, what do you think about the of A, B and C? Then now I have I've been invited to something. And you can do that very subtly. I gave Lazelle in my article as the example, whereas, you know, it's basically the setup in a conversation about Lazelle basically being just an alien, being stuck in, you know, in the Forgotten Coast. And now what do you, you know, what's that like? And she's going to have opinions about that. And you want to talk to her about that. And, you know, I could have stopped the dialogue at one place and then let the player just sort of ask. But instead, if you add a line that means the player needs to really respond to this, in this case, it's Lazelle saying that large fleshy nose of yours looks like a mistake. Now, I can tell the story about Lazelle being a fish out of water. I can tell a story about her being an alien, about her not being familiar with the land, about her not necessarily being familiar with your species or who you are. And I can do that in a very specific way by her mentioning the size of your nose. I can also put in reactivity, which is really nice, because if she's talking to another Githyanki, now we have a completely different set of circumstances and a completely different dialogue. Or if she's talking about a Dragonborn, if you're a Dragonborn player, now you have a different set of things. And so you can kind of accomplish a lot of things at once. You accomplish the player actually kind of having a feeling about what she said, because she just insulted me. And now I want to have something to say back. And that's a lot more powerful to me, because now I'm invested in this character, as opposed to, boy, tell me about what it's like to come from outer space or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's personal. And it, whenever you can make a dialogue personal, it's a lot better than making it abstract.
So I kind of get this sense that it's almost like the conversation is the metaphor of the frisbee, right? Like the player tosses a frisbee to the NPC and they catch it and they hold the frisbee for a bit, but you have to make sure they end the conversation throwing the frisbee back. So at the point of choice, the frisbee is in midair and the player's only choice is to catch it somehow or to drop it and be the one who dropped the frisbee, which of course nobody wants. So that way you can kind of keep that momentum going. I one thing that's interesting about that to me is because when I was thinking about the idea of NPCs who are kind of pushing their agendas and pushing the story on the story that they want to tell onto you, which is something that you mentioned in the article, I was thinking, oh, okay, does that get in the way of the player having agency? Perhaps the player feels a bit frustrated that they're not driving more of the conversation or driving more of the plot. But actually, the way that you phrase it there, I start to wonder, does the player have too much agency? Because every character constantly wants to know what the player thinks about everything. You know, it's like, yeah. I'm choosing my breakfast yogurt. Hey, player, should I get strawberry or raspberry? But presumably this is just a question of balancing what you're doing and the degrees and the specific.
It is. You have to thread that needle. I mean, if you're using a trick that's obviously a trick, people see it.
Yeah.
And now you have a different kind of problem on your hands. So part of that trick, though, is to make sure that every situation is as different from the last as you can make it. So a situation where, you know, I'll give another example of a dialogue that our incredible Sarah Bayliss, who is forever the queen of writing conversational dialogues that sound natural and perfect. And it's something that I aspire to that I don't know that I will ever reach that height of being able to write that kind of conversational dialogue. But she wrote Volo. And there is a scene very early on where Volo wants to talk to you about what it is that you saw outside during this battle. And instead of saying, you know, what did you see out there? He says things like, the dragon, was it the of the bronze or the silver variety? And you know, it's just something like that. That's all it takes. Instead of saying, tell me what the battle was like, you know, tell me about the dragon. And now you've also done characterization. You've also characterized Volo as somebody who wanted there to be a dragon and is going to, in his version of the story, put a dragon in there. And therefore, now you've characterized Volo within two lines. And so you've, again, a lot of these things, you can kill those two birds with one stone simply by kind of letting the NPC tee up the choices that come after.
So you're sort of packing more momentum into the script, and at the same time, you're packing in more characterization and more world building, just because it's everything's getting stuffed with as much as you can give it.
I mean, that's the trick when you're writing a game that has hundreds of thousands of lines of dialogue. But especially now that we have cinematics, we can't rely on, for example, in DOS 2, we really relied on that narration a lot to describe what was happening on screen, because we could not depict it. So now that we have more tools at our disposal, and that was, by the way, as writers, that was a big hump to get over for us. We got so used to being able to, you know, poetically describe whatever was happening on screen. Now we're in a situation where it's like, okay, now that, you know, people are hearing every line and seeing it spoken, this changes the pace of how you write and what you write. Because players are a lot, at least in my opinion, players become a lot less patient with watching really long conversations play out when they actually see what's happening on screen, where they might be a little more forgiving, where it's mostly just words that you're reading, or even if they're voice acted, I think that they're still a little more forgiving. But suddenly you have a full cinematic, and that pace changes. And so one of our initial goals with BG3, and it took some time to get there, was packing as much information and characterization as you can from the moment a dialogue starts. And something like Volo, who Sarah wrote, is, I think, one of the prime examples of how to do that in BG3.
Well, it's funny you say this. Earlier in the conversation, you brought up the topic of, should dialogue sound like how people actually speak? And Sarah Bayliss's Volo, you're saying, like, is a perfect example of characterization efficiently done while conveying the information that was necessary. It's funny, for a lot of high fantasy, and these games included, we often write in a relatively elevated or arch language. It's melodramatic writing, which is amazing and lovely and wonderful, but is only one type, of course, of writing. You included that Lazelle example of the nose in your article itself as something that was more expressive than the previous version of it, that in the order that you had put it, right?
Yeah.
Does that style of writing just give us more options than perhaps a more day-to-day quotidian style of writing? Or is there something about that genre writing that lends more to it? Or could we be achieving this almost, you know, no matter the setting, no matter the structure?
I think you can achieve it no matter the setting, but I do think that we have a leg up when we're writing in a very heightened way. What I meant before about, like, I don't necessarily need characters to talk like the way that we talk to each other. What I do want to believe is, I want to believe that character talks like that in this place at that time. That's what I want to believe. If that's authentic, because now that's based on the world that's around them, all the people that are around them. Now, if I can believe that, it doesn't matter whether they talk like I talk. What matters is that they're talking consistently in a way that fits the setting. And it also leaves a lot of room for somebody who does not come from that setting, or if you have a setting that encompasses so many different ways of talking. I've been watching The Expanse recently, for example, and you've got a lot
so
of...
Good. So good.
It's really good. And you've got a lot of different ways of you've got a lot of different accents out there, because there's storytelling in that. And the same way in one of our games is, you know, you write in a heightened way. Now I can tell a cool story about, you know, the Githyanki coming from another plane, and they have a completely different attitude and a completely different way of speaking. And I can contrast that with, you know, this is the way people on the you know, on the Sword Coast speak. And as long as, you know, and now you get to the Duergar place, and now I understand that this is kind of how Duergar speak. And therefore, when I write a Duergar who doesn't speak like that, you understand that this is outside of the norm. And yes, you're conveying something that way. And that's honestly, that's a lot of fun to work with that stuff. And that's honestly, my strength as a writer comes from, I think, is writing in that heightened style. And I was really glad on BG3 because DOS 2, I felt like I was writing very particular types of characters. And then in BG3, like the range was so much bigger, and that made it a lot more fun, to do that, because then I'm writing mushroom men, you know, and I get to devise an entire way of how they talk. And that was so much fun to do. And now you're talking to Duergar, and now suddenly I get to make up as many potential swears, bullet storm style, as possible. And, but that's, So I do think that we do have a leg up on setting up good choice when you have a colorful world where everything is heightened in that way. May I give one more example of that I really
love? Please, do.
Yes.
This is the work, the collective work of Jan van Dasseler, 80, and John Corcoran at Larian, who all worked on Gale at a particular time. And I call this the Frasier effect. So I sometimes think about how on Frasier, the very obvious foil to somebody like Frasier, who's you know, all snooty and self-important and whatever, is to have, you know, somebody who's the opposite of that. Instead, the foil you get is somebody who is more that.
Even more
in the way of Niles. And so I often go to Gale, and I think one clever thing, again, that working, I would say that Frasier kind of works in its own heightened universe, right?
Yeah, for sure.
More true to life, but certainly heightened. These are not probably people that we're hanging out with. So you have somebody like Gale who speaks quite eloquently, and in long sentences, and kind of has a way of, you know, maybe, you know, two words stretched into 20. He's pretty good at that. And then you meet Elminster. And Elminster is five times that. And again, I think
you can't miss it, right? It's very obvious.
And I think that working in a universe like ours, working in a fantasy universe or in a sci-fi universe, and or just, you know, going out on a limb, really does afford so many benefits of being able to make choices like that that you can't make when you're just writing whatever.
It's wonderful to be able to hear a writer just describing this process of working in a situation with, you know, a fair amount of power, a fair amount of freedom, and also just a huge playground in which to play. It sounds glorious, frankly. I'm sure it isn't always, but like, I love the amount of creativity that and kind of opportunities for creativity and for style and for flair that, you know, are clear from the sort of the way that you're describing it. I wanted to raise one other thing. We're actually kind of almost at the end of time, but I wanted to raise one other thing. I wanted to get it on tape, which is in your article, which is modestly called Two Tips for Better Writing by the Dialogue, and has at least 15 tips in it, like, I'm sure, minimum. At one point, you casually, I'm just going to accuse you of this, you casually give a taxonomy of what player replies in dialogue could be, and you say,
I'm glad we're covering this. This is good.
World reactivity, where the you reflect changes in game events. Self-expression, where the player asserts a belief. Emotion and insight, where the player wants more answers to story and lore and is doing information gathering. Pacing, it's a long dialogue and you need to break it up with a moment of interaction. And just because choices are supposed to be in games, so here's a choice. Which I thought was a brilliant taxonomy. I thought it's probably true. Suspect it's on the one hand, you quite possibly wrote it off the top of your head. I can imagine that it's battle tested somewhat under quite a large number of dialogues that you've written at this point. So I love that, and I thought it's well worth people who are kind of coming into branching narrative writing just knowing that list, because I think it's a great list. But I wanted to ask about the just because choice. Yeah, absolutely. So basically, can you give me an example of a just because choice so I can get a handle on what you mean by it? And secondly, the way you phrase it makes it sound like it's perhaps a choice that shouldn't be there. Is that what you mean? Or are there cases where the just because choice is a wonderful thing?
Well, it depends on how bad the pacing is at this point. Hopefully you don't add it just because the dialogue has gone on so long and you have no idea what to say. In my opinion, if you've reached that point, you need to just go back to scratch and find a different way of telling the story that you're telling in this dialogue. I'll tell you where that came from specifically is I have a bad habit of playing certain gacha games. Mm-hmm. And there are several gacha games that really love that idea of, and it's not just gacha games, but there are games that love this idea. I've been listening to this character talk for a long time. Now they've suddenly, for some reason, decided that I have to have some kind of input. And so they give me two almost identical lines to choose from, and I choose one.
Right. Yeah.
I really, really hate that. And I know that hate is a very strong word, but I don't think that the player benefits from that moment. I don't think that the game benefits from that moment. And I think that everybody is better off when it's left out. Mm-hmm.
Wasted opportunity, right?
It's a wasted opportunity. If you're not going to take the opportunity to allow the player to express something, at very least, make them two very different options. If you're going to do that, but if it's basically just two slight rewordings of exactly the same thing, then just don't. I know that's very strong, but it is something. It's one thing that I do feel very strongly about.
In
that particular case, I know we're going to wrap up, but I will say that. You know, I'm a big fan of the idea that a choice that you make in a dialogue doesn't have to be some kind of world-changing or character-changing choice. What matters most is just the player expression, because that's where role-playing lives. If no role-playing is living within the choice that I make, then something's gone wrong, in my opinion.
I'm going to squeeze in a couple of questions before we totally close. But I think it does occur to me that some of the times I've seen those types of choices happen in game genres that are attempting to do different things, I guess, than roleplay. For instance, I feel like in visual novels I see these types of choices a lot, like the ones that you're talking about, and they aren't. I never think as a player like, oh, this is like some real choice that I'm like expressing something.
Yeah.
They are almost like chapter ends or like little mini bookmarks or like those bits in a chapter where there's like a double new line gap. And then you sort of start a new section. So because sometimes those are actual bookmarks that you can rewind back to or something jump to the next choice or something. But they're not necessarily needed to be there. But all in all, yes, in general, right, I think it's much more fun to do something that isn't quite so mechanical as that. Perhaps, Kevin, you think even in that case that's like a bit too far.
I mean, everything has an exception, right? Like, and we all know the realities of game design. We always know that somehow, sometimes there just has to be a thing there for some reason that is not player facing, and yet we had to put it there because there's some maybe non-ridiculous reason why that thing had to be there. And in that case, it had to be a button press or something like that. Yeah. And what better way to get a button press in than for the player to express something? But for the most part, to me, if you want to do something like that, because in most cases, there still is a different line after whatever it is that the player said. And so to me, if you're going to take this opportunity to put in your choice, you know, just make them different enough or have different enough flavor between the two of them. I know you have to be very careful with this stuff because you don't want a player who's typically just blank slate on the screen, which is where this often happens, is you have blank slate character who never necessarily talks and you almost never have a chance to tell them what to say. You know, if you're going to do that, at least give them enough difference, give them enough different color between them that the player has a sense that, you know, they're, you know, they're getting a chance to express something, even if it's minor. I think it's better to put in some kind of, you know, expression there that the player can see, rather than, you know, stop or halt being my two choices, because those are the same things. And that's what I'm getting at there. If you're at a place where you're either putting stop or halt as your two choices when you get to that spot, there's probably a better way. And that's really my only point there is like, if you got to do it, then give it a little thought. That's all.
Well, let me ask then something about to bring us out of the just because and to just ask a bit more about some of the characterization you were referring to, because if there's been a theme to this podcast, it's how can we both characterize the people we're speaking with and the people and the character themselves that's sort of covering things.
Yeah.
It does strike me that one thing particularly unusual about the size, about the games that you make is their scope, is the fact that you can have Gale in that initial scene and have more than enough time to get to know what Gale's style is, so that can then be given a foil later on, and then see what Gale's opinion is relative to that, right? And see kind of how he goes for those things. That feels luxurious to me, right? It's very feels to luxurious. Me sometimes that like I'm so limited. Yeah, like I'm so limited on how many scenes I have with a given character that each scene has to do so much work that it can be you kind of don't have the space to explore it from all these different angles. Is that how you feel sometimes, that you can sort of see, you have enough space in the game to see these characters go through different arcs, or do you too feel constrained or a little bit limited in how you can express?
We always
them?
Feel constrained, right? We always want to make the game of our dreams, and I always want to make you know, every character, you know, have, you know, if I had my way, every single one of our origins would now have a game of their own, and they would all go off to their own spinoffs. And, you know, I have an entire story about what happens to Will and what happens to Lazelle after the games, you know, but this is not in my hands anymore. But it is very luxurious, to the point where when I can't get that much space and still want to tell a big story and have to be told, you're trying to cram too much into too little space, it's sad. on the new project, I will speak in very vague terms. I did have a situation where I basically ended up telling an act's worth of story for an NPC in the course of like three scenes, and it didn't work well. But I've gotten so used to the luxury that I'm like, but I, again, we talked earlier to bring it all the way back. Some of that, a lot of that had to do with fear. That had to do with the fact that I felt like I had a lot of stuff that I had to communicate to the player, and felt like it all had to land on this particular character. And when I realized that I have a lot more room and a lot more characters and a lot more places to stick lore and to stick actual story and that sort of thing, again, you pare down what I had. I didn't have to lose any characterization or any spark or any color. It just meant that I had to put off the details till another time.
So to summarize what I'm hearing about your advice, it's keep it brief, use brevity, keep it compact, keep it dense, and that's how you make massive games. So long as you shrink everything down, your game can be enormous. That is a wonderful piece of advice.
I guess it does sort of sound counterintuitive, but we also have luxuries that other people don't have. Like I get to say, I need another NPC because there's more to be done here, and I have too much sitting on this NPC. And that doesn't mean that sometimes we don't break our own rules. If you played BG3 and you ever met Gortash, you met one of our biggest rule-breaking NPCs in the entire game, where 7,000 story elements kind of land in one place. And there kind of wasn't a way around it. Sometimes you do sort of, it's the equivalent of painting yourself into a corner, and sometimes you just have to work with what you have. Sometimes you can't iterate to death forever because you have to release a game, which is one of the hardest things about making a game like we do.
That's right,
is that it has to come out, because you could spend forever making it better and better and making it work the way you want and telling more and more story and doing more and more with the characters. But eventually, yeah, it has to get in people's hands. And sometimes you have to just decide where the lines are drawn. And boom, now they're drawn.
I think actually that there's a lot of sense. It does sound counterintuitive, but I think there's a lot of sense in this idea that a really dense style of storytelling does scale up better because it's consistently interesting. Yeah. Whereas if you have a very bland, kind of very superficial level storytelling, when you try to scale that up to a big story, it's just all the same as itself. And after a while, people are like, I've done this a million times. I can't do this another. So, yeah, I think that richness is something, that I think it's a wonderful thing to aspire to. Kevin, you're clearly like an expert in and a battle-weary warrior in the field of branching dialogue. So it's been an absolute delight to have you on the program. We better wrap it up there, though. I'm sure we could all learn much more from you. So thank you very much for joining us. Listeners, please join us again next week when we will invite another luminary from the Kaleidoscope on to talk about their approach to interactive narrative. But for now, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
See you later.
Thanks for having me.